fantasy sports fans, and welcome to the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and as you may know by now, I am a golf fanatic when it comes especially to the majors. I like golf, period. I enjoy playing it. I enjoy watching it. I watch it on the weekends. It doesn't matter how weak or how empty the field is. I am watching it on weekends. But the majors are special. And I think even if you're not a golf fan, you can still enjoy the drama and the intensity of the majors. And to me, they're the best events of the year, at least the three of them. And golf has actually been changing the scheduling in the future years to try to make the PGA an equal to those majors. And we'll see if it works out. But to me, at least, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the Masters are three of the best five or six events in all of sports, all of sports. At one time, boxing was, in my opinion, a great sport, at least maybe not great. There's lots of reasons why it's maybe a bad sport. But the fact is that it was enjoyable. When a Mike Tyson fight happened, things were crazy. It doesn't have that cachet anymore. To me, the majors have that kind of cachet. And there are other things that are close. I love March Madness. The Super Bowl is fantastic. But to me, the majors, and the fact that it's also 4 days. So it's not really an event in the sense. A lot of times an event is a one-night thing. But the major is 4 days. The drama builds. You watch the horse race. It's sort of like, I love the Kentucky Derby. I love the three horse races. I love seeing a horse try to go for the Triple Crown. To me, that's sort of what the majors are. It's a four-day kind of going for the Triple Crown. You do well in the first event. That's essentially Thursday. And then you get to the final, the Belmont, and try to win the whole thing and be a Triple Crown, which is so rare for horses to do. To me, that's fantastic. That's what the majors are, because usually they're close. If it's a blowout and someone wins by 10 shots like Rory McIlroy did in Virginia a few years back at the U.S. Open, you know, that's a bust. Just like if one horse wins the Kentucky Derby and the other wins the Preakness, and then what's the point in watching the Belmont because it's all over. But for me, the majors are fantastic. We like to talk with Chris Mascaro from Next on the Tee as well as Thursday Night Tailgates when we talk majors, and we are going to talk with him tonight on the program. If you want to follow me, again, my name is Chris Mitchell. This is the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show. You can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73. You can also go on Facebook. I have a couple of different sport posts. It's the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show page on Facebook, as well as a podcast to be named later, which is a baseball podcast, if you want to follow that as well. We can talk in those groups. If you want to just post things and get into a little bit of a debate on issues, by all means, go over there to join. But tonight we're talking about the British Open. We're going to talk about Carnoustie. We're going to get into the conditions. We're going to talk about the course itself. We'll talk about the sleepers. We'll talk about the players involved, who's got a chance, who doesn't have a chance, things like that. Chris is as good as you get when it comes to the history of golf. He also is just playing good as an analyst. He does his golf show as well as his football show, both fantastic podcasts. So he comes on and kind of lectures me on the courses, tells me what players are good and what aren't as far as the conditions and the setup of the course. So we're going to talk about that tonight. Let me bring Chris into the program. Chris, thanks for coming on. Love talking these majors with you. And it's the middle of July, and of course that means the British Open is not that far away.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back with you again, Chris. Missed you around the Masters time, but it's great to be back with you here as we look at the Open Championship. And here we are. It's the middle of July. This year has just sort of flown by, and it's going to be even worse next year, as you were talking about a moment ago, as we switch up the schedule and get the PGA Championship moved into May. So next golf season, it's really going to be condensed. But, really looking forward to this Open Championship. I think it's going to be a fantastic tournament. Carnoustie, or Carnasty, as the players call it, is going to be probably the most difficult challenge that they're going to face over the next several years. Might be the most difficult golf course that there is. So I'm really looking forward to hearing how that goes for a couple of reasons. One, as we saw around the U.S. Open and how much the USGA gets hammered for scores that are well over par, I think we're going to see scores very much over par, and we have traditionally seen that at Carnoustie, particularly with the weather and the wind. So I'm interested to see how the players deal with that. They don't deal with it well here, and they're quick to point a finger at the USGA for letting the course get away from them. I'm really interested to see, on the heels of what we saw a couple of weeks ago at the U.S. Open, how they deal with the conditions and the course over at Carnoustie.
And that segues perfectly into what I wanted to ask you about as part of the meat of the show, which is when I was going through, I went over to the Carnoustie website and I went hole by hole. I saw the flyovers and the descriptions. And the first thing that I do when I go to a golf course to play is I look at the cards, because I don't usually play blues because I'm an okay golfer. I'm probably pretty good compared to a lot of people, but I'm still a hacker. I still shoot in the 80s at easy courses, mid-90s at the hard ones. I can shoot over 100 if the course is a real tough one and I have a bad day. So I'm not a horrendous golfer who goes out and shoots 130, but I'm not a good golfer either. And so the first thing I do is I look at the length to determine whether I should be playing the blues or the whites, and I almost always come up whites. Because, in my opinion, if you're hitting driver, three wood on par fours all day, then you shouldn't be playing the blues, and that's how I look at it. I looked at Carnoustie, and at least in the front nine, it looks like it's a very short course, but of course, as we know, and we talked about this in previous years, weather has a huge part in it. And it's not just that it makes it more difficult, but it makes the yardage play in a lot of cases a lot longer. And you talk about how difficult this course is, but I saw a lot of par fours under 400 yards, which professionals, I mean, that's a tiny distance-wise. Explain to me why this course is so difficult. And if I'm wrong, by all means, correct me. But explain to me how this course is so difficult when the yardage-wise, it looks like it's pretty short. And in today's game, short means, in a lot of cases, easy.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting, Chris, because, you know, first of all, Carnoustie has a very interesting layout. A lot of holes, or the majority of the holes, are going to be playing left to right. So it's certainly going to favor a player that can, you know, is a natural fader of the ball. But when you look at the distance, right, first hole is 499-yard par four. So that's certainly, you know, right up there with what we're used to seeing for these guys and the hole distances. But you're right. We've got some, you know, 370 to just at or just below 400-yard holes. Now, where it gets tricky and where these guys are going to have to, you know, obviously with the wind, we'll put weather aside and just say, what makes this course difficult? Well, out of bounds comes into play an awful lot. Obviously, when you're looking at a course on the R&A Rota, you've got a lot of pot bunkers that come into play. You've got very narrow fairways, right? And you'll see it early on in the golf course, especially on two, where guys try to get into that hole, which is 461 and a par four. But if you got some narrow landing areas, and again, you're going to see out of bounds come into play a lot here, Chris. You know, you go back to 2007 at the Open Championship, very first hole, Tiger pole hooks his out of bounds, so he already starts hitting three when he's you know, just getting the tournament's just getting underway for him. So it's going to be out there for them to hit. Now, it also comes into play when you get around the greens. So, and then you've got water that kind of snakes its way through this golf course. And then, you know, what makes the golf course very difficult is it plays into some very stiff breezes. So I think you've got some narrow landing areas. You've got the pot bunkers. You've got out of bounds that comes into play very frequently. And then the weather on top of that. So Carnoustie is a very difficult golf course. The last four holes are going to be fun to watch because they're probably the four most difficult finishing holes anywhere in golf, and in 18 being the most difficult hole on that golf course. And certainly everyone remembers what happened in 99 with Jan Vandeveld on 18. So this can be a tough golf course, and the conditions and the layout are certainly going to be the reason why.
And every time we talk about the British Open, we talk about how weather and kind of the reputation of some of these British Open courses is that if there's not bad weather or at least inclement weather of some kind, weather, usually wind, then the course can be defenseless. Could Carnoustie play defenseless? Is there a chance the weather could do that? Or is there can we guaranteed absolutely know that this is going to be a tough test, that the weather is going to absolutely be difficult or something like that? Because, again, with these yardages, it seems like if the weather is easy, if the weather is harmless, those yardages are very short. But are we basically guaranteed the weather will at least add to the challenge, or could it possibly lay down and make this an easy course?
I don't see any way that this course lays down. And let me give you a couple examples for where it's going to get difficult, right? You talked about, you know, hey, you look at the fourth hole, which is only 350 yards. I mean, the hole three, 350 off the tee, right? Well, heck, you know, Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, those guys, they should be able to drive the green, cut the corner, drive the green. It just doesn't play that way. You've got too much trouble out there with the burn, with OB, and then with the wind and that sort of thing. You just can't cut these corners. You're not gonna see a guy on the third tee, you know, aim way to the right. Don't even consider landing it out in the fairway and just go for the green. You've got ditches, you've got water, you've seen, and we saw it a little bit even at the U.S. Open, but traditionally at the Open Championship with the burn, I mean, you hit a ball into that stuff and you could be hacking out two or three times just trying to get your way back to the fairway, and the next thing you know, you're hitting triple. So I think because the course is the way it is, I think you're going to see a lot fewer drivers, especially on the front nine. I think you're going to see a lot of driving irons because guys are going to want to keep it low and in, you know, underneath the wind as much as they possibly can. So I think you'll see some. I think you'll see some hybrids. I think you'll see some long irons. I think you'll see a lot of driving irons. Guys trying to keep the ball, because you got to keep the ball in the fairway. And anything you start to stray, and now you bring all kinds of trouble into play. And I think you're going to see a lot more conservative play. And if the wind is up, and it typically is, you know, over in an Open Championship, particularly at Carnoustie. It's not like we've seen Carnoustie lay down in the past, right? You go back in history and you want to say, well, you know, what are the winning scores have been? I mean, we've seen some that have been, you know, in a what we would, I think, typically want to see, like in a U.S. Open or in a British Open. I mean, Patrick Harrington in 07 won it in a playoff over Sergio at -7. That's a reasonable score. And a major championship, a -7. But, you know, you go back to 99 when Laurie won that in the playoff over Vandeveld and Justin Leonard. They finished +6. That was the winning score. Tiger, you know, was a tie for 7th that year at +10. Phil missed the cut at +13 through the first two rounds, 79-76. So this course is going to play difficult. It's certainly at its most, you know, you say, hey, could it lay down completely? Could these guys just tear this golf course apart? I just don't see it. You know, I think if you want to be an optimist and say, hey, these guys are, you know, are very good with technology and the advances and how far guys are hitting their tee shots these days, could we see a marginal under par? Yeah, I think we could. I think a winning score right around what Harrington had in 07, a -7, I think would be the biggest optimistic view of what this thing could do if it plays easy. I think this golf course is going to end up somewhere right where we saw Brooks Koepka win a U.S. Open. And I think somewhere right around, you know, +4 to maybe 1 or 2 under par at best are what these guys are going to walk away with. I think right now, if you went up to any of the top players and go, look, I'll give you -2, they'd sit in the clubhouse and wait all day and say, I'll take the -2 and see what these guys can do.
When you say a finishing score of +4, maybe even +6, you're hitting erogenous zones with me. I love to see those kinds of disasters. So if they can come to something like that, you're getting me excited here, and we're more than a week away here. I love to hear that kind of stuff. -12, -7, hell no. I want +4, +6. I love that. So we're not going to see a John Daly where he can maybe overpower like a St. Andrews, it seems like. If the weather's really weak, you can just overpower that course. That's basically the layout makes it almost impossible to see that possibly happen. I like to hear that.
Yeah, no, I think this golf course has got too many twists and turns in it. It's got too, you know, like I say, you know, many times out of bounds comes into play too often. The pot bunkers are perfectly placed. The burn is in place. You've got water, you know, like I say, that snakes through a few of these golf holes. You've got narrow landing areas. Sometimes you're going to see that the guys are going to have to back off a little bit and not hit driver. That's going to leave themselves with a longer second shot into some of these greens and the longer par fours. The par fives are all going to be very gettable, Chris. I think, you know, there's only a couple of those out there, but they're very gettable. They're very short, and I think that's where you're going to start to see certainly a lot of birdies and eagles. Those played as the two easiest holes on the golf course last time, and that will certainly hold true again this year. So there's going to be opportunities for guys to put their foot on the accelerators. They're going to have to take advantage of those couple of par fives, but I think just as equal as that is they're going to have to rack that up, because coming in down the stretch and on some of these holes, like I say, you're just not going to be able to go for broke. There are too many, you know, dog legs that go left to right, you know, predominantly that they're going to have to play. And some of these are going to have to play conservatively, because again, if you stray off these greens and get yourself, whether it's in one of the pot bunkers or in the burn or out of bounds, then you know you're bringing six or seven into play. So I think there's going to be a lot of conservative play out there, and certainly just like we say all the time with an Open Championship, when there's bad weather, or when we're talking about a U.S. Open and there's bad weather, or they you know with the conditions and the rough and that sort of thing, patience is going to be a key. The guy that can keep the ball in play and have patience and take his medicine when he has to, and you know be patient and let the course sort of come to him. That's the guy that's going to be holding the claret jug come Sunday.
One of the things I really like about the British Open is that the pot bunkers or any bunkers are truly almost penal. A lot of times guys have to go sideways or they at least can't go all the way to the greens. And that's one of the things I really like about the British Open. And for me as a hacker, anytime I'm in the sand other than near the greens, I'm actually very good out of the sand around the greens. But if I'm in a fairway bunker, that's basically penal because I just can't hit the ball normal distance. I miss hit enough that when you hit sand, you know, your ball goes 70 yards rather than 170. So a fairway bunker is always penal for me. But these pros are so good that if they're in a normal bunker on the PGA Tour, it really almost doesn't matter. That's not the case in the British Open. These are truly penal. That being said, when I was looking at the Carnoustie layout, they seem like they have the bunkers are still penal. But it seems like there's a lot fewer of them than in some of the roto courses. Is that correct, that this course, while it has its bunkers and they're definitely going to play a role? I remember there was one course, I don't remember which one it was, but there were just hundreds and hundreds of bunkers. Carnoustie isn't that way, right?
Yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah, Carnoustie is more strategic, and their place where typically you would see guys hit their drive if they stray a little bit out of the center of the fairway. You could find yourself in a pot bunker in the fairway. And then obviously they're surrounding the greens. And a lot of times the bunkers are there and they would catch guys like you and me, but they're not going to catch these guys. You know, they're well short of the green or well left or right of the green. So that's really there to catch the big errant shot. Or again, you know, if the wind is really up and you're going to carry the ball and you start to get it offline and then the wind takes it the rest of the way. But not as much as we've seen on some of the other golf courses out there in the R&A Rota, but still enough there that, to your point, if you find yourself in one, they're not the one that, you know, if you end up anywhere from, you know, 200, 150, even 100 yards out, depending on where your ball rests in that bunker, you're just getting it out of the bunker and then taking your medicine and taking your next shot. It's not like these guys are going to hit it in there. They got 200 yards to, you know, to the green, and now I can still take my 7-iron, 6-iron, get it out of the bunker and get onto the green. Doesn't happen in these. You're going to end up taking a higher lofted club, putting yourself in a position where maybe you're 50 or 100 yards out of the greens and trying to get up and down and make par. So they're certainly penal.
We're talking with Chris Mascaro from Next on the Tee, the golfing podcast. A fantastic podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at CT Mascaro. I recommend you go over to Twitter, follow him, and follow his podcast. He does a football one as well, the Thursday Night Tailgate. Very successful podcast, fantastic guests, really good shows. So for all of you out there who don't know who Chris is, I recommend you follow him on Twitter and follow his podcast. You mentioned technology a second ago, and I actually did want to ask you about this before the show, but since your opening speech was so good about the conditions, I just rolled right into that. But I want to ask you about this because when I was reading about Carnoustie, it says here, the sixth hole in the championship course was officially renamed on Wednesday, blah, 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 Hogan's Alley, because of Brett Paul Lurie mentioned it. And they said that they went out and had essentially a long drive contest using Ben Hogan's, the exact same club driver and the same golf ball that he used way back in 1953, which was a 1953 driver and a 1.62 golf ball. What exactly 1.62 means, I don't know, but the ball that back then was different than it is now, and that's what it means to me. And on the long drive, a guy named Arjun Atwal was the long driver of the entire group, and he only hit it 251. Now, granted, they're probably hitting into the wind, but when I see the club that they were using, a 1953 driver and a different ball, only hitting it 251, I just wanted to ask you real quickly, because you follow golf a lot more closely than I do, and you have access to all the people that know these kind of things. That essentially almost tells me, even with the wind, we're talking about drivers and golf balls allowing players now to, on average, not the longest hitter, just on average, to hit the ball somewhere between 75 to 125 yards longer than they were hitting in 1953. Is technology that big of an impact on today's game? Because I read that and I was stunned that Adam Scott could only hit a 231 with a 1953 driver and a 1.62 golf ball. 231. Adam Scott can hit it 331 if he wants to a lot of times these days. Is technology, the clubs, and the golf balls that significant a change? I mean, that to me, it struck me so much that I wanted to ask you.
No, and that's a very good point, Chris. Yes. The short answer to that is yes. Technology in the game. Now, I mean, you know, there are a lot of factors, right? I mean, the guys are bigger, stronger, and all that sort of stuff. But technology has had a huge impact on, you know, where we are with the game. And, you know, you go back not even all that long ago. I mean, you know, to go back to Jack Nicklaus's time when he was out there dominating the tour, you know, could he hit it over 300 yards? Yeah, he could. But it was rare. It wasn't like, you know, those guys were averaging 300 yards. I mean, you know, guys were averaging in those days around 270, 280, you know, at a max off the tee. And now, you know, to your point, guys are easily hitting the ball, you know, 300, 300 plus yards. I mean, we've seen Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka all hit over 400 yard drives. I mean, that's unheard of. So, yes, technology has had a huge impact on the game. It's going to have a huge impact on the future of the game. And that's where you start to get into the debate on, you know, do we need to roll the golf ball back? I mean, even Tiger Woods, that, you know, in his early 40s now, is hitting it just as far, if not further, than he did, you know, back in the late 90s, early parts of the 2000s when he was dominating the tour. How can you do that some 20 years later? Well, the technology is that much better. I mean, you know, it's uncanny how far guys can hit the golf ball, and for you and I, Chris, you know, the average guy, the argument against that, the opposite argument is average guys like you and me aren't hitting the ball any further than we did years ago. Why? Well, I mean, we're not as big and strong as these guys. We don't practice, you know, like those guys. We don't have the club head speed that those guys do, but they swing the, you know, the club head speed is 120 plus, and typically got, you know, guys like you and me, we're somewhere in the 90s. Well, that's going to add a whole lot more distance to the golf ball or to the drive than what you and I can do. So technology is a big issue in the industry. Obviously, as you can imagine, the major manufacturers have no interest in rolling the golf ball back. There's this discussion of bifurcation, right? Different set of golf balls and golf clubs and rules, if you will, specifications for the tour players than for you and me, right? Let us continue to hit whatever the newest technology is. Let us enjoy the fact that we're getting more distance, hopefully, out of the golf ball. And let's dial that back a little bit, because the trickle-down effect is, if you want to have a championship on your golf course, right, you want to get your course on a PGA Tour or on an LPGA Tour or somewhere on a USGA Tour, you're going to end up having to, you know, invest in more land, which costs more maintenance, more water, more upkeep. You're going to have to keep stretching those golf courses out. I mean, heck, how many times, Chris, have we heard over the last several years of Augusta National having to move a tee back, buy more land, right? That's the thing, right? They bought more land. They're going to end up, you know, elongating hole number 5. They bought the land behind the 13th tee to, you know, move that tee back. So it's all in relation to the technology and the distance a golf ball is flying. So you make a very good point, and that's very interesting to learn how far those guys, the distance that those guys could hit it with that equipment versus what we see them do week in and week out.
Yeah, it was remarkable. I couldn't believe that Adam Scott could only hit a 231. I mean, in a hurricane, I would have thought he could have hit it further than that. So it just struck me. I had to ask you, even though it's a little bit off topic, but getting back to the meat of the discussion earlier in the show, you mentioned the conditions in the left to right and out of bounds. I like to always ask you every single time we go to a course, you always know the specifics. I don't know how you know the ins and outs of every one of these courses, but I never feel guilty asking you, because you always seem to know the ins and outs of how these courses play and be able to adapt that to who it helps or who it hurts, who it gives a little bit of an edge to. You talked a lot about left to right. We talk about the Masters, who that helps, the layout of how that course is and what kind of player and who benefits from that kind of layout. Who benefits from the way Carnoustie is laid out? Is it lefties? Is it righties? Is it, you know, are Europeans significantly better off because they hit the ball lower because they're used to the wind? I don't know. Who benefits and who's kind of hurt by the way Carnoustie plays, the layout and just the conditions and everything involved?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think when you look at who benefits, well, obviously the European, you know, tour players are going to have some benefit because they're used to playing in these kinds of conditions all the time. But it is a, you know, random mix. You go back and you look at the Open Championship winners. It is a pretty mixed bag of, you know, who has won over the last several years, right? You've got, you know, players from the European side. We've got several Americans that have fared well. So I don't think, you know, just nationality and that sort of thing is going to say, well, the Europeans have a home course advantage. So, of course, you know, one of their players is going to win. I think, you know, because we have, you know, great players here that, you know, are used to those kinds of conditions. The guys that, you know, play in Texas and are, you know, from the Plain States, that Florida, you know, the out in California, where you're used to playing in a place like Pebble Beach, or you're used to playing in the Byron Nelson Classic every year and the winds in Texas. You're used to that sort of keeping it underneath the tree line, hitting a low runner, punching the ball versus a high ball flight. High ball flight is why, you know, I don't like Jason Day this week or in any Open Championship, because he's got such a high ball flight. But the natural fader of the golf ball, I think, you know, because there are so many that bend from left to right, are going to have an easier time. Someone like a Dustin Johnson, who brings both a power hitting game and a natural fader of the golf ball, I think it's going to play well for him. Experience and strategy. The guy that can strategize is going to have a leg up on the rest of the field. And a player like Justin Rose comes to mind. He, you know, obviously, having played over there for so many years and being a part of the European Tour before coming over and spending the majority of the time here on the PGA Tour, but still a wonderful ball striker, a guy who can play the ball in either direction, but is a good left-to-right player and has the experience and the patience and the strategy to take the course apart and know how to play the angles, will have a wonderful advantage going into next week's tournament. Other guys, you know, when you look at experience, strategy, can play the ball in either direction. Obviously, we know what Tiger can do, and as much of a long shot as people want to make Tiger going over into this event, we've seen him play well a couple of times this year, and he certainly has the experience, and Tiger knows how to play the ball in either direction, as does Phil. And we saw Phil win an Open Championship just a couple of years ago. So, and we know what a great short game that Phil has. And Phil has added, you know, putting very well. You know, take away the U.S. Open and the train wreck that we saw there. But Phil is number two on tour this year in putting. So on top of being creative, great out of bunkers, can hit the ball a long way, can get up and down from all kinds of crazy places, even though he seems to struggle getting his driver into the fairway with any sort of regularity, as does Tiger. But they're both very creative, and they're both very good around the greens and can sort of see shots that guys like you and me don't see, right? I don't see how Phil hits so many of his shots because I don't see the small degree window opening that he sees. And he can do the quick math and the angle and all that sort of stuff to figure out which loft he needs to hit and how to make that come off perfectly. So I think it's going to play to his advantage. And it, you know, again, the European players do have some advantage going in there, having, you know, that sort of experience and playing on or in those conditions week in and week out. A Tommy Fleetwood comes to mind. I love Tommy's game. We saw him play so spectacularly, you know, the 63 on Sunday at the U.S. Open, and he's one of the top players over on the European Tour for a reason. And Alex Noren, the same sort of thing. He's a good fader of the golf ball. So I think, you know, what you're going to see is the guy that's got the natural fade, the guy that's got the experience and the patience and the strategy to kind of pick it apart, right, and do the math to say, okay, here on this hole, I'm going to have to play left into a right green that's got a pin that's on the right, and to be able to kind of put that together and pull off the shot in the wind are going to be the ones that have a lot of advantage. And I think those are the players that are from Texas on the European Tour, from California, that played a lot on the coast with the wind and the ocean and all of those sorts of conditions. Those are the guys who are going to play well. And that's why, you know, DJ's at the top of that list.
And every time we come on this program, I usually ask you about Tiger and Phil, and you covered that extremely well right there. I don't need to ask you about those guys. Another guy that I think maybe I could be perceived as being a hater of, when I'm as far from it as you could be, but I've been critical, not critical, but skeptical about Jordan Spieth, because as I've said many times, I just don't see the upside in him. I don't see him. Dustin Johnson has just so much pure, raw physical ability. it's just, it's awe-inspiring what he can do with the golf ball. And now that he's doing it consistently, it doesn't surprise me in the least that he can basically win any tournament he wants to. I mean, in reality, he's probably the most talented golfer in the entire world when he's playing at his best. He's just too physically gifted. I look at Jordan Spieth, and I see him as less physically gifted than most players, which is what's so remarkable about how such a good career he's had so far. But that, to me, puts a limit on his upside, and there's a lot of room for him to really fall because he just doesn't have that huge upside that a Dustin Johnson has. What are we seeing from Jordan Spieth? Because he's so good, especially when it matters, and he seems to be so smart, and he was great in last year's British Open. So when you look at the way he's playing now, I can see why you wouldn't want to pick him, say, for a fantasy lineup. But at the same time, he is a player that is always winning. He's always in contention, even though his game seems to be way off at the moment. What's your take on what we should expect from Jordan Spieth?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time with Jordan, too, and he's my favorite player out on tour. He's the guy that I root hardest for, but I would have a very difficult time saying that he's got much of an opportunity in this Open Championship. And the reason being, you know, you talk about the physical gifts and how far you can hit it and all those sorts of things. And Jordan isn't there with, you know, the guys like DJ and Brooks Koepka and those guys. Where Jordan excels is around the greens, right? We've seen him. He's a wizard with a wedge in his hand. And, you know, when he's chipping around the greens and, you know, shots gained, you know, around the green, he's always near the top of that. What's disappointing about him this year is where he gains the advantage typically is with the putter. And Jordan is just struggling hard with the putter. And that, you know, obviously the flat stick is what got him to the championship last year, right? I mean, you know, the bomb he made, you know, on 16 and how he, you know, got all of that rolling, and the putter is what really made the difference. Jordan's not going to outdrive anybody. And, you know, his shots to the green, you know, getting, you know, in regulation are good. He's really good in greens in regulation, but he's not that good at getting the ball close to the hole. What he's good at, typically, and we saw him be at times the best in the world, is 25 feet in. Right? He was making everything. Well, now he isn't making anything. He's the exact opposite of that. So, you know, and that goes to, you know, confidence. That goes to, you know, we've seen it with Tiger, right? Tiger, you know, has been struggling with the flat stick. He's made a change with the putter that got everyone going, right? So it's all about the putting. And, you know, Tiger was the best putter in the world for so many years. You just knew everything was going in the hole. And now you look at it and go, nothing's going in the hole. And the same, you know, is true for Jordan. I don't think he has any confidence when he's over the ball. We've seen Jordan miss putts 18 inches, 2 feet, 3 feet. You know, isn't making no short ones. I think that's gotten in his head a little bit. So he needs to kind of get through that, right? We saw Jordan sort of exercise the demons at the Masters on 12, right? He finally got it over Rae's Creek and got it on the green on Sunday and then made a birdie. So, you know, maybe he slayed that dragon. Well, now the dragon is the 2 and 3 footers and just, you know, putting in general. So until he's able to get past that and get back to being the Jordan Spieth that we knew, that was the strength of his game. Around the greens, on the greens with his putting, that's where he was so much better than a Dustin Johnson or a Brooks Koepka or a Rory McIlroy. That's where his advantage came. Inside of 50 yards, around the green, and on the green. And that's just not the case right now, at least on the green. So that's what makes Jordan just sort of an average guy out on tour. Until he gets to the place where he used to be, you know, he's just going to be that. I mean, since his third place finish at the Masters, his best finish is a tied for 21st at the Byron Nelson. So that's not the Jordan Spieth we know.
Yeah, and that was my concern, and you've heard me say it on many a time when you come on with these, is I just couldn't believe he could keep up putting at that 25-foot distance and more, where he was literally doubling. He was lapping and then some the field at how successful he was at that distance. I just didn't think anybody could keep up that pace. It was insanely remarkable how good he was compared to everybody else at that range. That was where my concern always laid, is that he was at a pace where it was just impossible to keep up. That was always my concern. No matter how great someone is, you can't be that much better than literally everybody else in the entire world. That was where I always kind of had a problem. And I root for Jordan all the time, too. I say this every time I ask you this question. But let me ask you about the field and specifically Bubba Watson. I watch golf every single week, and it seems like this year there isn't really anybody that seems to be dominating. I mean, Justin Thomas last year went out and won like 5 or 6 times. It seemed like every single week he was in the top 5. It seemed like there were a few players last year where they were consistently the best. This year, it doesn't really feel like anyone is the best every single week. It almost also feels like a lot of weeks the matches aren't that close. My recollection, it's just a feeling. I haven't done any math or anything on it, but it felt like there was almost a playoff every single week last year. This year, it almost seems like in a lot of cases, going into Sunday, it almost seems decided. Now, that's not the case. A lot of weeks have been actually contested, and they've had some playoffs. So I know that that's not actually true every single week. But going into every single week, it just seems like almost anybody can win. And you see a Bubba Watson, for example, who's won 3 times this year. He's probably the player of the year on tour right now because he's won 3 times. Is the field truly just demonstrably wide open this year, or am I just misreading what I'm watching on the weekends at this time?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, every golf tournament is wide open. I think there are so many talented players out there, and more talented players. The pipeline is full of talented players, you know, joining the PGA Tour. Guys out on the web.com tour that are on the cusp of getting their tour cards and getting out on the PGA Tour. I just think there is so much talent that you're right. Anybody could win in any given week. I think that's why it's hard to have a dominant player, as much as you talked about a little bit ago, Dustin Johnson being a guy that you would think is so physically gifted and can hit the ball a mile, is just not dominating the tour anymore. That's not going to get it done week in and week out. You just can't bomb it and win because so many other guys can bomb it and win, right? I mean, there's so many guys that are driving the ball 300-plus yards. So I agree with you. I think it's wide open. I think anybody can win at any given time. I think you can get hot and, you know, go on a bit of a run maybe for a week or two, but it's not going to be sustained. You're not going to see a guy go out and win 8 times like we've seen Tiger do in the past. There's just too many good players out there to contest every single week. So I think, you know, the great thing about that is it makes the tour engaging. For me, my opinion or what I like to see is that I like to see a wide open tour where anybody can win any week. And it's, you know, this guy one week and it's another guy another week, mixing all of the young guns sort of in there, the Justin Thomases and the Jordan Spieths and the Ricky Fowlers, you know, and the Xander Schauffeles and, you know, et cetera, in there. And then, but you still get the sprinkle of the veterans. You get a Phil Mickelson who's still relevant and still, you know, finally wins a golf tournament again after a few years of not winning one. You get an Ian Poulter who comes back and wins a golf tournament. You see a Jason Day, who was the world number one for a long time, make his way back and get a win. And then you got the guys that are just there week in and week out, the Justin Roses, who are always near the top of the leaderboard, and they get a win here, a win there, but are second, third, fifth, you know, kind of getting those wins. And then, you know, you root hard for the guys like the Kevin Nas and the Francesco Molinaris, who have been out there grinding for years and years and years, and then come up and get a big win like Kevin Na did this past week at the Greenbrier, or Molinari did at the Quicken Loans National a couple of weeks ago. So it is, to me, it's a wide open tour. Guys are winning, and it's a wide variety of them, and that's what, you know, makes the game so great, in my opinion.
And before we get to the fantasy foursome and a caddy selection, the aspect of the show, which is what we're going to wrap up with real quickly, because you gave us a lot of guys you liked in this week, and I think you pretty much every time we talk about the British Open, there are certain general guys that fit it, but specifically to Carnoustie, is there a couple guys that you just think this course fits them better than just everybody? It's like you look at this one guy and say, this guy is so good because he's straighter this, or he's so great because he's the best in the out of the bunkers. Are there a couple guys that specifically fit Carnoustie's layout better than everybody else and just stand out as the easy best choices, or is it just the field and you like certain guys for other reasons? But specifically, are the couple guys like at the Masters, it seems like you have a few guys that you just love because of the way the Masters course itself, like Augusta, lays out for them. Is there any player or a couple players that Carnoustie fits that description?
I think there are two players that I love this week, and I think Carnoustie plays in their favor. The first one is Justin Rose. I love his game. He's the world number 3. He rarely has an off week. He's always near the top of the leaderboard. And I think he is a guy, you look at the experience, he's played out there, he's played at Carnoustie several times, he's used to, you know, the conditions over on the European Tour, having come from there, and I just love the way where his game is at. I think Justin could win at any tournament, on any layout that there is, whether it's over on the European side or it's here in the States. I just love his game, and I think it's going to lay out well. And I think the experience and the strategy, the way he dissects a golf course, I think he's the number one player this week to look out for to win. And the other one is Tommy Fleetwood. I mean, Tommy has just been a dominant player on the European Tour for the last couple of years. He leads the European Tour in greens in regulation. That's 63 at Shinnecock on Sunday, that, you know, leaped him right up, you know, to the top. I thought was a remarkable round of golf, and I think those two players are one and two to be looking out for this week. I think both of those guys are going to be at the top of the leaderboard on Sunday.
And before we get to your foursome and a caddy, quickly, dark horses and sleepers. You threw some names out there. Who are some guys that either you would never think would possibly win a tournament, or maybe because of Europeans, we just don't know them? Who are some dark horses, sleepers, or just unknowns that you like this week in general?
Yeah, I mean, Rafa Cabrera Bello, I mean, we're familiar with him, you know, over here. We see him every once in a while, particularly at the Masters. I think his game is fantastic. I think he's sort of a dark horse to win. Some of the more familiar names, of course, over on the European Tour, and Alex Noren. He's only played a handful of tournaments over on the European Tour, but he's got three top 10 finishes. He's a guy that could play, you know, could be right up there at the top. Let me throw a name at you, a guy from Spain, Jorge Campillo. And he's played 16 tournaments this year over on the European Tour. He's finished in the top 10 six times. He's right near the top in a lot of the categories over on the European Tour. I think he's a dark horse that he may not be as familiar a name to folks, but I think he's going to become a more and more familiar name over there. Another guy who just won in dramatic fashion, Russell Knox, is hot over on the European Tour. So he's a guy that we see his name periodically in an Open Championship. So I wouldn't be surprised to see his name on the leaderboard. And, you know, obviously Francesco Molinari, who we just saw lap the field practically a couple of weeks ago at the Quicken Loans National. He's played well over on the European Tour for the couple of tournaments that he's played over there. And obviously his game is in fine shape. So I think those are some guys that will fare well, and I wouldn't be surprised to see their names on the leaderboard throughout the week. And on the opposite side of that coin, I mentioned earlier, I don't think this course lays out, nor do any of them, over on the European side for Jason Day. I think Jason hits the ball too high, and with the wind conditions that we typically see in an Open Championship, I think that's why he struggles, and we haven't seen him play all that well over there. So I don't think the course is going to play well for him. I think there's some, Brooks Koepka is a 20-1 odds, you know, to win over there, and I just don't see it for Brooks either. He's certainly got the power game, and I think he's got the demeanor to win anywhere, anytime, but, you know, I'm sort of stuck on Brooks Koepka. I mean, he's only got three PGA Tour wins. Two of those happen to be U.S. Opens. So I think he's a guy who should win more often, but he doesn't. And I don't expect a lot out of Brooks Koepka this week over there. So for all the reasons that this course plays into DJ's favor as a, you know, power player, as a fader of the golf ball, and all those sorts of things, I don't think DJ has the patience or the ability to strategize as much as he's going to have to win. And he's not in my foursome either. So I don't think that this is going to end up being a successful week for DJ.
All right. We're talking with Chris Mascaro from Next on the Tee, and we're going to do the final segment here with his foursome and a caddy. Now, your boy Uwe Louis Oosthuizen is automatically included. So technically you're playing a sixum. So you're granted, you're not supposed to play a sixum, but if you're out on a hacker course and you got a couple cases of beer in your bag, and you can squeeze six onto a foursome. I've done that before. It takes forever, but if you want to sneak it in, you can do it. And that's what we're doing. We're going to have a sixum, unless you somehow, for some reason, are divorcing yourself from Uwe Louis. You no longer, because you've loved him for many, many years. It's almost a fetish level love. So he is a bromance. As an honorary It is. So he's an honorary sixth member until you say that the divorce is final. So you're saying now it's not final. He is going to be your sixth this year as well.
Oh,
until
absolutely.
Further
I love, you know, I love me some Louis Oosthuizen. So Louis is too consistent and to not be included.
Anybody that I can say Ooey Louie is a good thing. He's got tons of vowels in his name, so I'm all on board for having him as your sixth member for as long as you want to put him in there. So he's your sixth. We got to get to four and a caddy. You mentioned some guys you liked, but let's just make it official so I have you on the record. Who is your, I guess, number four? Start at the bottom of your guys you like the least of the best. So who's your four, and then give me three, two, and one, and then we'll throw the caddy in there, and hopefully there's a little bit of color with that one.
All right, so I'm going to throw my number four guy is Sergio Garcia. Why Sergio Garcia? 25-1 odds, 10 top 10 finishes in the Open Championship, including a couple of runner-up finishes, including the last time it was played there. So I love me some Sergio Garcia this week. He's leading the European Tour in scoring average. So I think Sergio, you know, could be a guy that could play very, very well. I think, you know, ever since the Masters, I think the monkey is now off his back and he can play a little freer. So I'm going to say Sergio is my number four. Ricky Fowler is my number three. And why Ricky? Well, you know, we've seen Ricky, you know, be in and around the leaderboard for a long time. We saw him finish solo second at the Masters this year. So he got close. And I love the way he finished that golf tournament by birding 18 to put a little pressure on Patrick Reed. So I just think it's, you know, eventually it's got to be Ricky's time. Too good to not win a major. And so we've seen Jordan Spieth and Zach Johnson, you know, together, you know, flying back from an Open Championship, drinking out of the claret jug with JT in tow as well. I don't think this course sets up enough for JT. I wish it were a little bit better. I love JT as well, but I'm going to say this is going to be Ricky's time to be in and around the top of the leaderboard as well, and maybe he's the one carrying the claret jug so the other two guys or other three guys can be drinking on his private jet back to the States on Monday.
That's an interesting one because instinctively, Ricky Fowler doesn't come to mind as a British Open kind of guy. I see him almost like he's not like Mickelson. That's probably not fair, but just the way he hits the ball, and he just strikes me as a guy that the British Open and the conditions – wouldn't necessarily automatically just make me think Ricky Fowler. So that's an interesting pick. Caught me off guard a little bit. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, every once in a while I got to throw you a curveball, Chris, because I come too predictable with who the top four are. So he's three.
The Ooey Louie love has caught me off guard for years. But anyway, go ahead.
My number two player is Tommy Fleetwood. As I said a moment ago, I mean, Tommy's playing so well over on the European Tour and has played well over here. So I think he's hot. And, you know, coming off that, you know, his performance at the U.S. Open. And again, as a guy who leads the European Tour in greens and regulation, anytime you can do that, you're going to make a lot of pars at worst. And that's what's a key to in a major, and particularly if the wind's blowing hard and the course plays as difficult as it did in 99 when Lowry won at plus six. I think he's a guy that can put himself in some good positions, and he's got a great opportunity to win. And then Justin Rose is my number one guy, and for all the reasons I said earlier, he's just too consistent, too good. He's always around the top of the leaderboard, and I expect him to be right there as well this year. I mean, he's number three in the world, and rarely do you see Justin Rose play poorly, so he's my number one guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always thought he was a good player, of course. I remember when he was, 19 years old and hit that bunker shot on 18 at the end of the British. So I've always remembered him. It does amaze me that, like you said, he's essentially Matt Kuchar, only he's much more successful. He's as consistent, but he finishes at the top more. Kuchar is just always successfully competitive, but he never wins. Rose is just as consistent, at least right now, but he finishes closer to the top and he actually wins. And it surprises me. Maybe again, with all the, I throw out the word parity, maybe that's why Rose is at the top, is because in the world of parity, he is the best of the parity. Maybe that's what it is, but it does. He has been successful, and it surprised me. Last one, give me your caddy, and then we're out of here. I'll let you go.
So from way downtown, like I mentioned a moment ago, Rafa Cabrera-Bello is a guy who is 80-1 odds. I think he's a guy that could win, pardon me, come come Sunday. Let me throw another guy who we're a little more familiar with over here, but I expect to play well over there, and that's Brian Harman. He's 125-1 odds. But Brian is a guy that, to me, is an up-and-comer that we've seen him play well. We've seen him play well in a U.S. Open in the past. I think he is a guy that's just getting his game rounded out and could be a guy that will be in and around the tops of leaderboards here, at least in the States, for many, many years to come. I love that kid's game. I love his mental approach. I love, you know, he's a lefty, and I think that's going to suit him well. I think he's a guy that could be donning a green jacket before very long. So I love him as a very long odds. And then a guy who's not quite as far back, and a guy who we've seen play well here recently, is Bryson DeChambeau. You want to talk about a guy who's a statistician and a tactician and can, you know, kind of make his way and figure out the angles and where do I need to be and do all of those sorts of things. It's Bryson DeChambeau. I love that kid's mental makeup. His game sort of comes and goes, and that's, you know, his swing is a little different, but he's a guy that can go station to station. I wouldn't be surprised to see any one of those three at least be contending.
What do you think real quickly about Jon Rahm? Obviously extremely talented, pounds the ball, very emotional. He can be, you're afraid he might break his clubs out there every single week.
Yes.
What do you think of his chances?
I mean, I think he's got as good a chance as anybody. He's got a great game as anybody. Where I think he lacks is what you just mentioned a moment ago. It's in his mental approach. And in a major, you've got to be mentally sound, right? You can't get too up. You can't get too down. And I think he does both of those things. I mean, he's won over on the European Tour for sure. And he's one of the top 5 or 10 players in the world. And I love his game, and I love what he can do. What I don't love is the emotional side. I think he can get himself as quickly as he can get himself to the top of the leaderboard as quickly as he can fall off of it. A missed swing here, a bad break there, a ball in the burn here that causes, you know, him to have to, you know, suck it up and make a bogey, tends to turn into a double bogey, which tends to turn into a club slam, which tends to turn into a bad stretch of holes, and now he's no longer at the top of the leaderboard. That's where I think he's got to harness it. I think he can. I mean, we've seen the same from Sergio Garcia in the past. We've seen the same from Seve Ballesteros in the past. It seems to be a thing that runs into some Spaniards where, you know, it's the hot blood, man. It's the high emotions. It's the motor running hot. All the talent in the world. I just think he's got to harness the emotions, and I haven't seen him do it in a major yet. He got close in the Masters, certainly made a run there at the Masters, but then fell back. I think the same could be said. Until he kind of gets over that, I don't think he's going to be a contender. That's what I think his downside is, but he's got a great game.
Louis Oosthuizen's benefactor and our favorite golf guy, podcaster from Next on the Tee as well as Thursday Night Tailgate, that's Chris Mascaro. You can follow him on Twitter at CT Mascaro. Chris, great, love talking some fantasy golf with you. British Open, fantastic. Last question before I let you go. The tour's changing the way that they're scheduling next year. Is this going to matter to the PGA? Is it going to have an impact in general on golf? Do you have any general thoughts about how they've changed the schedule and moving things around here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned. I mean, you know, Chris, I'm more of a traditionalist about this, right? So I'm a little sad to see the PGA moved up to early in the year, and I get it. Hey, it's tough going up against the NFL, right? And they don't want to do that, and I get all the reasons why you don't want to do that. But, you know, the way summers have been set up for you and me throughout, you know, our lives, Masters is in April, you know, the Players is in May, the U.S. Open is in June, the Open Championship is in July, and the PGA is in August. It sort of kept you through the summer. Well, next year, not so much. It's going to be over early. And, you know, this time next year, we'll be talking about the last major of the year. And I think that's tough. I think, you know, again, for the TV ratings and all of those sorts of things and not wanting to compete with the NFL come, you know, August and September makes all the sense in the world. But, yeah, I think it's going to be odd that the golf season, if you will, and again, you know, the wraparound season to me is kind of silly. I don't get, you know, the October, November, December, you know, the season ends at the Tour Championship at the end of September, but then it kicks right back up 2 weeks later. I don't like that either. I used to like silly season. you know, when you had, you know, the skins games and all of those sorts of things that happened in the, you know, October, November kind of time frame, and things sort of shut down, you know, and most of the best players in the world only play every now and again in the wraparound season. But I think it's going to be an odd year next year on the PGA Tour, and I'm interested to see what impact that has, because everything trickles down off of that, right? I mean, we're all creatures of habit. And, you know, and when you look at just the trickle-down effect into, you know, merchandise sales and equipment sales and all of those sorts of things, I think that's going to have a big impact, because, you know, it's all going to be compacted into a couple of months, and then it's going to die off. So I think it's going to have a big effect across all of, you know, the golf industry, and not just on TV viewership and the tour schedule. I think it's going to have a big impact, and I'm really curious to see what that's like. And I'm a bit sad that it's going to be kind of jam-packed into about a three-month span of time and not spread out over the course of the summer. It gives guys like you and me something to look forward to, one thing a month starting in April, and we're not going to have that as much.
Yeah, for me, horse racing is about the big three. I don't care about horse racing at all. I don't go to the track. I don't watch any horse racing except for the three big ones. For me, golf is about the four biggies. Without having one of the biggies in August, that to me, or cover late August and towards the end of the season, that is weird for me. It almost seems to me like they want the FedEx Cup to mean more. That'll be the end of the year thing. Is everyone, to me, the FedEx Cup doesn't mean a whole lot, to be honest with you. I follow it, but that horse race just doesn't seem to have the draw to me, at least not yet. It seems like maybe they're trying to create that. Maybe they're trying to force us to care about that because all the majors are long gone since then. Maybe that's part of it. It feels that way to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long dry spell between the Open Championship and you get to the Tour Championship. And my concern is that people will have moved on even more away from golf, and the Tour Championship is going to become even less relevant. People will be way into college football and the NFL when there's not a PGA, you know, championship to kind of bring us back a little bit in August, and then we look forward to the, you know, the season ending in September at the Tour Championship. You know, being here in Atlanta, yeah, it's a big deal here in Atlanta. But I'm concerned if, you know, for the golf fan, you know, they're going to start tuning out come Open Championship time, you know, the weekend after, where we're going to start tuning out of the, oh, by the way, tournaments that fill out the rest of the tour. And when the Tour Championship comes, it's going to be so far out of mind, and we're going to be so ingrained into the football season, it's going to become less relevant.
Could be. Chris Mascaro from Next on the Tee, as well as Thursday Night Tailgate. Promote anything you got, man, and thanks for coming on, and get the heck out of here. I kept you too long. I apologize.
No worries. Look forward to this week on the show, Thursday Night Tailgate. Tomorrow night, we've got Ross Tucker joining us, Tony Collins, former Patriots Pro Bowl running back who joins us every single week, Marco Iannuzzi, former BC Lions wide receiver and the guy who won Canada's Smartest Person. You want to talk about two guys that you look at their educational background. Marco Iannuzzi from the Ivy League school. He went to Harvard initially, then went to MIT. And then Nick Lowry joins us right after that, Nick being a Dartmouth and Princeton guy. So two guys on the intellectual side that really have no peer and had great careers. Marco out there on the CFL, Nick Lowry for so many years with the Chiefs and the Jets. And then we'll round out the show with Chris Dishman from the Oilers. So great show that we're looking – Bob, my co-host Bob Lazzari and I are looking forward to tomorrow night on Thursday Night Tailgate. You can catch it live streaming on Blog Talk Radio, but available as a podcast over on Podbean, iHeartRadio, Audio Boom. Really, any place you can consume podcasts, you'll find our show. So check us out Thursday Night Tailgate.
And if you can, since you have all that brand power, feel free to ask them about NAFTA and tariffs, if they can solve our problems or how we get Trump off of these things. By all means, feel free to throw out to those geniuses. And I'll tune in for that for sure.
I appreciate you, Chris. And then the following week on Next on the Tee on the golf side, we've got Billy Casper, CEO Peter Hill, joining us, as well as golf course designer Reese Jones and former PGA Tour player Tim Simpson. So look forward to that on Next on the Tee the following week.
Fantastic. I recommend everyone out there follow Chris, listen to his podcast. They're fantastic. Chris, thanks a lot for coming on. Enjoy the Open. Granted, we're doing it a week ahead, but it gives plenty of people to listen and plenty of people to prepare. So thanks a lot, man.
Absolutely, Chris. Always a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Once again, that's Chris Mascaro from Next on the Tee, as well as the Thursday Night Tailgate. If you like golf or you like football or you just like just listen to interesting conversation, regardless of the topic, you definitely need to be following Chris. And you can follow him on Twitter to find all of these different things. His Twitter handle is at CT Mascaro. That's the best way to do it. Find him on Twitter. Follow the links. Look to where you can find him. And that way you can also find him. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I can help you find Chris as well. At CJMitch73 for me. And this podcast will be posted on Facebook as well as on Twitter. So if you want to find me that way, head on over to Facebook, the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show, or a podcast to be named later if you're a baseball fan. But the easiest way to always find pretty much everybody, if you want to stalk somebody for that matter, head on over to Twitter at CJMitch73 for me. Please don't stalk me. But if you want to find something, if you want to find Chris, if you want to find some fantasy stuff, I can direct you from there. So at CJMitch. Mitch. At CJMitch73. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming on. Hopefully, you're a big golf fan. Hopefully, the podcast helps you out. Hopefully, you enjoyed the program. And again, thanks again to Chris Mascaro for coming on. Everybody, be good, be safe, and enjoy your summer.